We're looking at the relationship between faith and reason. And this is a complex subject. We're just going to scrape the surface of it. Philosophers have wrestled with this subject for centuries. And it's very important. It raises issues like, what is the relationship between religion and philosophy? Lots of debate about that in the past and in the present. What's the relationship between religion and science? Huge issue for our own day. So this matter of how these two relate together, our faith capacity, our reason capacity, is very critically important. And it's part of the contemporary discussion. How much can we trust religion? And I'll define that word a little better as I go along. But how much can we trust religion to tell us things that are true and reliable about reality? And of course, many today would say absolutely nothing. I don't know if you've seen Bill Maher. He's the American comedian. He put out a mockumentary called Religulous. It's a takeoff on ridiculous. Religion is all ridiculous. And the world would be a much better place if we just scrapped religion, all religion. It's a scourge. Now, there are a range of positions people hold as to how faith and reason relate to each other. Some of these are very well thought through, and others are not. I want to begin by saying that everyone holds to some conviction, some belief on the matter in terms of how the two relate. And we act on the basis of our conviction. The convictions of the relationship between these two, which are wrong, have loads of fallacies which need to be uncovered and exposed. And my concern is that many Christians also act out of fallacies, that which is not true in terms of the relationship between faith and reason. And I think it's quite a foundational issue for apologetics to see how faith and reason relate together. So what I want to do as we get to this subject is to present five models. There may be more, but I can see at least five models of how faith and reason relate together. And the complication of what I'm doing here is that the definition of faith, what I mean by this word faith, changes in terms of the model that you're operating within, which is why I'm using words like faith and religion interchangeably. And that's part of the complication, that we don't have a set definition of what these words mean because our models are so different. And depending on what the model is, will change your definition. So hopefully this will become clear as we go along. That's why faith is so confusing to so many people today. So the first model, I think they're in your notes there, is reason against faith. And this position, which is dominant in the modern context, says that faith must work without the help of faith. Reason has to work without the help of faith, and that faith, meaning religion here, has no place in the pursuit of truth. And this is the position that undergirds books that are much talked about by Christians. You think of Dawkins' The God Delusion. Religion, it just gets in the way of that which is rational and true, so we need to scrap it. So reason, in a very aggressive manner here, turns against faith and religion in all of its forms. Now, this has a long pedigree. Dawkins didn't invent this. It goes right back to the Enlightenment. So the Enlightenment philosopher John Locke puts it like this. Belief, and he's thinking of religion there, is a persuasion that falls short of knowledge. So you're not going to get to truth through faith and religion. Faith doesn't and cannot lead to truth. So reason is here attacking faith in all forms. And most philosophers have operated in the modern period from this perspective. It's been defaults. And one of the major contributors to this philosophy and this way of approaching things is Descartes, René Descartes. Many would call him the father of modern philosophical thinking. And it's interesting, Descartes wasn't setting on his project to attack religion. In fact, Descartes is a Christian. But he's living in an era, a moment of history, where there's loads of skepticism around. science is now displacing the place of religion, and now science is on top, religion is beginning to get underneath, and he wants to redress the balance. So he wants to deal with skepticism. Because everybody around says, yes, that's right, John Locke, you're right. Faith is a persuasion that falls short of knowledge. So what's he going to do? Well, Descartes committed himself to an approach where he said what we need to do is bypass faith altogether and make God and religion secure. And the way to do that is based, therefore, on pure reason. If we start with reason and work our way through, we can build something that will have the clarity of mathematics. We can build a case for God, for Christianity. It will be self-evident. If we start with reason, we'll have something which is self-evident and can't be doubted. Very confident that he could do that. Now, in order to do that, Descartes had to create what I'm going to call a disengaged reason. Reason as a capacity of human experience. He disengaged, he kind of pulled it out and separated it from other parts of our humanity. So reason is disengaged, separated out, and thereby if reason stands here and looks at reality, it can see it in an objective manner. You can only logically think about objective truth if reason is separated out. It stands outside and sees the whole. That's the only way you can really arrive at truth if you're going to start with reason. It has to be pulled out. And you see there that faith can have no place in this kind of knowledge enterprise. It has to be expelled from the garden of objective truth. If you're going to get to objective truth, starting with reason, religion, faith must have no place. So it's reason against faith. The modern project is founded on this model. And of course it has a tremendous hold over the modern because it looks like it's been very successful. So interesting, Descartes didn't mean to kill off faith and religion in terms of its place in human culture, but that's what happened. And when people question this model, we as Christians question it, those who say, no, we need to stand for it, would look at the legacy of it and say, well, look, when religion was kicked out and reason was made primary and we said reason can arrive at truth in an indubitable way, it produced modern science and technology. So why on earth would you want to smuggle religion back in given what reason against faith has produced in the modern world? And as apologists, that is largely what we're dealing with. People who operate with that assumption. Science has buried faith. What on earth do you want to bring faith back into the equation for? So we have to provide an answer there. Now let me briefly uncover the fallacy in which this model operates. It's completely wrong. And it's wrong because it lives in the myth of pure objectivity. This is an Enlightenment idea. The myth of pure objectivity. And I say it's a myth because no matter how hard you try, you can never divorce reason, objective reason, from the knower, the subject. Reason is part of the subject. Reason is part of subjectivity. So all human knowledge involves both the human subject and the thing that is the object of our inquiry. You can't separate them. And that means there's a subjective dimension to all of our knowledge. Reason's not disengaged, it's part of what it means to be human. So when we use our reason, it's with our subjectivity, it's from our subjectivity. So the foundation of the modern world is flawed, and the postmoderns saw this and pointed it out very helpfully. Pure objectivity doesn't exist. Michael Polanyi was a Hungarian scientist and philosopher. In his book, Personal Knowledge, very difficult read, but he really helpfully exposes this. It's really a philosophy of science. He's asking, how does science work? And his basic thesis is that faith is necessary for all knowledge claims. So you take someone who enters the sciences. A 19-year-old goes to school and starts studying chemistry. Polanyi shows that you always start science on the basis of being an apprentice. And to be an apprentice means you don't go back to the very start with a clean slate, redo all the experiments to see if they're all true, and then say, okay, I believe that. An apprentice acts in faith on what is being delivered to him down through the ages. And what you do as a subject is indwell that tradition and stand on the shoulders of generations who have gone before. It's not pure objectivity. It doesn't work like that. Science doesn't function like that. So you indwell a tradition as an apprentice, and that becomes part of the equipment on which you rely as a science. You have faith in it. So you engage what's behind you with a faith commitment. And actually you treat that body that you inhabit as a scientist as completely reliable without testing it for yourself. You see a faith as part of science there? So it's not a case of pure disengaged reason, proving for yourself before you go on. You accept it in faith and then begin your experimentation. And Polanyi showed very correctly that this kind of faith commitment functions as a pair of lenses. You interpret what you're doing through that faith commitment. It's a presupposition that conditions your engagement with your science. It deeply impacts what you do. So he's uncovering the myth of science's pure objectivity. The scientist, it's true of the philosopher too, receives a revelation, not the biblical one, but a revelation of what is being, you receive it as what has come from the past. And you commit yourself to it. Now that is not the work of just brain, of mind. It's the full person who does that. Reason never functions in a disengaged manner. It's always bound up with all our other human capacities. That's what it means to be a subject, and we'll expand on that in a moment a little bit more. But that's why the reason against faith model just doesn't work. And we could say much more on that one, but I just want to lay it out briefly. That's the first model, reason against faith. The second model, in terms of how these two interrelate, is faith against reason. Now this is remarkably like the first model I presented in that it operates in a way that to show that reason and faith are completely incompatible. They're separated from each other. And this one simply reverses the model and pits faith against reason. Now this is often the response within the Church of Christ. When we're attacked and beleaguered by the attacks of the rational skeptics all around us, how do we respond? Well, our response often is to reverse the tables and to use faith against reason. So we turned it around and attack reason as something which is not to be part of our toolbox. As Christians, we become anti-intellectual. And I see this happening in many places in the church today. The attack is so great, the skepticism that we face from outside, rather than engaging it, we pit these things against each other. We say, our business is just to believe, just to have faith, and we become very anti-intellectual. It's interesting in the UK that some of the greatest anti-intellectualism amongst Christians are in the best universities, Oxford and Cambridge. Christians who are so brilliant in their fields, studying, and their studies are in one realm of life, and then their faith is in another. And actually, they say the faith is the more important bit, evangelism, my relationship with Jesus Christ, and their studies are here, they're unintegrated, and the priority is to faith, which ties into the lecture I gave on the first day. But the point is that it produces this anti-intellectualism. And the idea is that rather being on the back foot and always being defensive, we just need to turn it into attack and say faith is what matters. Faith against reason. Faith and reason, many say, are never meant to be in the same bed. They're just incompatible with each other, so they separate them. And we often hear this in churches who discourage any type of questioning. You ask a difficult question in many churches, and it's resisted strongly. Just believe. Don't ask questions. Just believe. See, faith against reason. Now, the faith against reason model has tended to reflect itself in two ways, both in the church and outside of it. It's reflected for me in what we might call philosophies of religious experience. It goes back a little bit to the Pietists. Remember what we said? Reason weakens religious experience, the experience of God. If you use your mind, you damage the possibility of an experience of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So reason is viewed with suspicion. And some within the church have seen reason as a total barrier to religious experience. And that's where many forms of mysticism go. Mysticism is saying the way to God is to actually bypass your reason altogether. Faith against reason. To embrace faith is to embrace something which is pure mystery. And to embrace pure mystery is to get rid of your rationality. You also see it reflected in what we might call various religious epistemologies. Epistemology is how we come to know that something's really true, and how we know, how we can prove that it's true. Now, within the Western philosophical tradition, some philosophers became what we might call thinkers of discontinuity. And thinkers of discontinuity says that if we're going to get at truth, we have to bypass reason. It needs to be unhinged from reason, our pursuit of truth, if we're going to get there. So Kierkegaard, who liked lots of his stuff, but this is an angle he began to take. Barth went in this direction. Some of the post-liberals within the church go in this direction. The idea is that reason doesn't play a coherent part in connecting us to what is true and to God. And they would say if you use reason, you will eventually arrive in radical skepticism. So the path of reason is an obstacle to faith. Reason generates many more questions than it gives answers. You see, it leads to skepticism. So, if you're going to know something, if you're going to know the true and living God, don't do reason. It's a hindrance. It doesn't get you to the knowledge.
Does it mean that our way to get to truth is only by revelation?
And yeah.
We should avoid reason.
Yeah. So do you get the truth only through revelation? In some ways, some of these thinkers would say that, but they also would define revelation in a way that I think we should deeply question. So revelation itself shouldn't be seen as something which is really true in terms of a description of the world, of the world and reality. Revelation is something which helps you have a kind of faith experience in which something becomes true. So it's not that the revelation is true, it becomes true as you have an experience of the revelation. So it's still a kind of discontinuity model. They're still within this line of discontinuity. So they might, on the one hand, say things about revelation that look very positive, but when you look at what they mean by revelation, it's very dangerous. It's not true. And actually, again, you don't engage your mind with it. But
and when did they first time appear, this idea of this philosophy of religious experience?
I think in the philosophical tradition, it begins to appear with Kierkegaard. And then I think liberalism, and there's different forms of liberalism, but some of the streams within liberalism stress this very, very strongly, that reason is not the path to God. One level, they're right. It isn't the only path to God. We'll get to that in a moment. But then they just define other ways, which was kind of the leap of faith in order to get there. So, good question. Let me keep going. Let me just quickly uncover the fallacy in which the second model, is operating in. Again, there's a kind of false dichotomy going on here. And the false dichotomy I see here is that to be human is to have all these range of capacities. And that means you cannot do anything without thinking. when I lay these out, there's a distinction between these various capacities. They can't be reduced to each other. So these all have their own integrity in terms of human function, the things we're capable of. But the thing to say very, very clearly ties in a bit with what Ellis has just said, that there's a total unity of these things. So anything you do engaging all of these capacities. There's a total unity here. So that means you don't do anything without reason. So we're doing some anthropology now. If your anthropology is biblical, you could never say that was a non-rational act. Even when you're sleeping, you're thinking. The only time you stop thinking, using your reason, is when you're dead. And there's different types of rationality that go on, but we never stop being rational creatures. That's my point. And this thinker, this kind of discontinuity model, faith, which is against reason, it just doesn't work in terms of what we are as human persons. Just a basic misunderstanding, like the first one, of how reality works. The first one saying that of course your subjectivity is functioning in all you do. So you can never have just pure reason. And it works the other way with the second model. Let's move now to the third one. The third model I present is faith over reason. And it's slightly different, which is why I think we can give it its own category. Now, in the first two models, there's a separation between faith and reason. They're divorced from each other. They're in opposition to each other. In the third model, both faith and reason have a function, but in a dualistic way. So faith, if you see the diagram, is consigned to the upper story of life, and the upper story is religious matters. And reason touches things in the lower story, which is the material world. It's where science operates. And what happens here is you have both functioning, but in a schizophrenic way. There's no attempt to harmonize here. There's a separation of function. Even if there's a contradiction, you just separate them. And you also see this dualism running through the stream of Western ideas. If you go back to Kant, Kant posited two realms of reality. You've got the realm of the noumena, which is the supernatural realm. That's where faith operates. And then you've got the other realm of phenomena. That's the natural realm, where reason operates. So reason for Kant and for others who followed him works very well in the natural realm. This other realm, reason has no place there, and it's about faith. So both are given a function, but they're not integrated. And this works itself out for me in the way lots of people function. We got very alarmed when we saw lots of non-Christians reading Richard Dawkins. Oh no, this is going to completely be an obstacle to faith. But I have no doubt that many people who are reading Dawkins one week, if you're sitting beside them on the train, you thought, oh, the God delusion, what am I going to do? Get all scared. The next week, you could well have seen them reading something like The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho. And so Dawkins, yet they just agree with it completely there, but they'd be quite schizophrenic. And they'd say, well, isn't Paulo Coelho interesting? I quite like that. It's a complete contradiction. They in this realm of life, yes to Dawkins, in another, they can take New Age philosophy and it works. And I think partly that works because today the modern functions in very different social spheres that are separated. So faith issues tend to be about private preferences. So we're very separated between what we are in private and what we are in public. So faith issues, Paulo Coelho is really interesting. But then in the public realm, where you need to work at what science is and what it says is true and how technology controls our lives, there you think, I want reason. Public realm, we'll have reason and science. In the private realm, we can have all kinds of weird religious things going on. A complete contradiction, and that's where many people are today. So you meet New Age people, and in their private realm they do yoga, some of the stuff that Ellis was talking about this morning, but in their workplace they're highly rational and they have models, and they don't see the contradiction there. So you see, they're both functioning. Faith is over reason, but there's no attempt at all at integration. So in a sense, I've already begun to uncover the fallacy of this third model. And the fallacy is the biblical view of reality that there's no separation between a religious sphere and a non-religious sphere. Christianity leaves no possibility for faith above and reason below. That's yet one more distortion of a view of reality. It's a fiction. It's an illusion of how things are. As I said the other morning, all of life is spiritual. So you can't divide up reality into religious space and non-religious space. And that means whatever belongs to reality calls for a response of reason and a response of faith. We mustn't divide them. And I'm going to develop that a little bit more in a moment. So you see how the first three models disconnect faith and reason. They're either against each other, the first two models, or separated. They both have a function, but we just have to separate them out. Biblical Christianity's truth must critique those three very strongly. Let me move now to the fourth model, and it's this. Reason leading to faith. Reason leading to faith. So you see, there's no opposition between the two here, and neither do they operate in separate realms. There's a connection between one's rationality and one's act of faith. And that enables one, therefore, to have a reasonable faith, which is a wonderful thing. They're not fighting. There's a coherence between them, a connection. We can have reasonable faith. And that means there are reasons for what we believe in, what we have faith in. And reason can play a significant part in leading a person to an act of faith. God exists, who's infinite, personal, Trinitarian, as we saw this morning, and relationship to this Trinitarian God is through the Son. Through the Son we come in relationship to the Father, and through the Father to the Holy Spirit. Reason can play a part in going there. That's what Ellis did. Ellis was preaching the gospel this morning. He was appealing to our minds and saying, look, this works. So reason can play a part. Now the question I want to ask here is, what is an act of faith? Well, for me, an act of faith causes us to bow, as creatures, before what we acknowledge as the ultimate. Ellis talked this morning about models of absolute reality. Everything in with nothing left out. That's naming of ultimate reality. And faith is belief directing the heart to what we believe is ultimate reality. And all human persons must do this. I might do it slightly differently, but just picking up from what Ellis was doing, it's good to connect things. Everybody has to choose one of those three circles. No one can remain neutral, can they, Ellis? You can't say, I think I'm just going to stand outside and see. We're in one of those circles. That means everyone is religious. And that means a scientific materialist is a religious being. It's a form of monism. Everything is atoms. C.S. Lewis develops this very well. So that means Richard Dawkins is religious. He has, with his capacity of belief in what is ultimately real, what is absolute reality, he has made a commitment to this. He has chosen it. It's what I call divinity status. We have to give divinity status to something when we call it ultimate. And this bowing is with our heart. It's the heart, which is our center and core. It's our heart, which is the point from which we choose absolute reality. Martin Luther says, whatever our heart clings to and entrusts itself to is unconditionally trustworthy, is really our God. Whatever we choose as absolute reality, we say is unconditionally reliable and trustworthy. And my point is that reason always plays a part in that faith commitment, the belief in what is absolute, ultimate reality. And it's faith that causes us to bow either to the true and living God, in Ellis's circles, Trinitarianism, the one and the three, or to a substitute, that which is not the true and living God, a lie. And reason helps us in that faith commitment. It leads to this act of faith. And that's why it's part of the role of apologetics to make reasonable the nature of reality and the role of the Creator in this. It's reasonable because the Christian description of reality is a true description based on the revelation from the God who did it all. We don't start from ourselves and work outwards to get to it. The God who is outside of reality, who is the source of it, tells us what it's like and how it works. Which means Christianity can be an appeal to the mind, which then leads to a faith commitment, where we bow with our heart. We make this religious bowing. Now, what I said here needs some qualification. I said a moment ago, reason is part of what leads us to this faith commitment. Reason does play a role in leading people to faith, to the heart bowing to what we name as absolute reality, which is the Trinitarian God. But it's only part because a human person is much more than a mind. Human person has a body. Every human person is embodied. That's the without aspect of what it means to be a human person. Every human person has feelings. From our bodies we have lower feelings. We have senses, sight. We hear, we touch, we smell, and so forth. Then we have the upper feelings, much more complex. Anxiety, fear, joy. Then we have reason. We have this wonderful rational capacity, which is connected to the capacity of embodiment and feeling. We're language bearers. We communicate. We make choices, significant choices that actually act upon the world we're in. And on it goes. We're social beings. To be human is to have membership in family, in nation, in religious groups. We're economic beings. This world is composed of material that needs to be organized and stewarded, managed well. We're aesthetic creatures. We're created for beauty. Everyone is. Everyone has this capacity. And we respond to it. We're moral creatures. When things go wrong, we say, it's not fair. Let's make it right. We're creatures made for love, to receive love and to love, and ultimately, in the bigger letters, we're religious beings. We have to choose ultimate reality. We're not just minds. And as I said, all of these are totally integrated. So each person functions in all these capacities. So that means reason leads to faith, belief, has a very critical role. It's kind of a gateway for me, which is why I take rationality, the mind, as something very important for apologetics. It's a gateway, but it's not everything. And this is really important. And that's why a good apologist pays lots of attention to things, the other parts of our capacity. Many apologists today, it's a huge defect, only pay attention to the mind, to rationality, to arguments. Win the argument and boom, people will come to faith. But that's actually devaluing a human person. A human person is not just a mind. All human persons are aesthetic. We have a capacity to appreciate the deep meanings of reality which art uncovers for us. You listen to a great piece of music, you can't reduce that to rationality, but it uncovers hidden meanings. Which is why art has a critical place in apologetics. And to treat someone as a mind, if they come to your house and they haven't eaten for 24 hours, non-Christian, you sit down, well, you know what, Dawkins, boom, 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 and you just the proof of the existence of God, that would be cruel. The first apologetic act when someone comes to your home is to give them a cup of tea and you're in England. That's apologetics. Because that's part of what it means to be human. And if someone looks uncomfortable as we're talking to them, they look confused, you don't just rattle on treating them as a mind. You say, well, you ask for clarification. They might look uncomfortable because they don't understand you. Well, that's a feeling. They're uncertain. or they might be hurt by something you said. So you treat them as feeling creatures. And language. Maybe you're not communicating very well. Well, they're not just minds, they're symbol users. So are you communicating well? And why not find new language to communicate more elegantly? That's my point. It goes all the way up. So faith, yes, leads. So reason leads to faith, but so do lots of other things. So we need to keep reason in its proper place as we think of the apologetic task. Let me move to the fifth model, which is faith or belief shaping reason. Faith shaping reason. Anselm gave expression to this in his famous saying, "I believe in order that I might know." Augustine said something very similar. He was critical to the thought of the early fathers. "I believe in order that I might know." Now, this is a very rich statement we can unpack for a long time, but basically, I believe it's saying that the act of faith precedes knowledge. So what we believe here, in terms of what we've said, is ultimate, absolute. What we believe here deeply shapes what's going on in our minds, rationality. So every person, as I said, functions here. We all have to choose something which is ultimate reality. We have this faith function. And this deeply impacts that. It goes both ways. That's the point I'm making. Augustine, remember his famous proverb, "You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." So our Creator has designed all persons as faith creatures. He's designed us to seek Him. And we either seek Him as He really is, according to His revelation, or this function directs our hearts to creation. But we've been made to seek God. God made us to seek God as part of the argument of Acts 17. The problem, of course, is that humanity has become corrupted by sin. So this faith function here chooses that which is not God. As Paul says, we worship the creation rather than the Creator. We choose for an idol. We choose for something in the creation that's then elevated above its station and said, this is absolute. This is ultimate reality. In the modern period, that's what a materialist done. A materialist says that matter, subatomic particles, are ultimate and self-sufficient. That's a religious statement. That's an act of faith. The heart bowing before what it believes is ultimate. Atoms. My point is this, that our act of faith touches everything in this list here. Because it's all integrated. So Dawkins' idolatry of materialism, and that's where so many people still are today, comes from an act of religious faith. The materialist, from the heart, from the reason of the heart, says the material is ultimate. And that shapes, drives all the thinking. Pascal, the heart, and actually the heart is the integration point for all these capacities here, every single one. The heart has its own reason that the mind knows nothing about. Very profound statement. So there's a reason here that drives us. Everything we do is driven from this point. And that's why we need this fifth model. We need to be reminded as apologists that every person we're dealing with is religious. They act in a faith commitment. And this shapes everything else. I believe in order to understand. And that's why when we argue as apologists for the rational credibility of Christianity, we must never lose sight of the whole picture. Yes, reason leads to faith, as one of a number of human functions. But we have to be aware that apologetics is always a battle for the heart. Always a battle for the heart. And that's why Francis Schaeffer says that every person to become a Christian has to bow twice. To become a Christian, you bow first with your mind, and then you bow with your heart. And I would actually say we bow in lots of places. We bow in our bodies, we bow with our feelings, we bow in all these places, and ultimately we bow with our hearts. We bow as whole persons. And that's why the goal of apologetics is not just to win the intellectual battle. The heart has to be turned. The heart has to be regenerated so it comes to its true source. And reason plays one role in doing that, but so does the imagination. Think of the aesthetic. And we need to keep that in mind as we engage the apologetic task. I think I'm thrilled for all the good work that's being done here, but I also have a concern, I have to say, that we put so much focus on the intellect, and we're ignoring lots of other areas which are so critical for biblical apologetics that deal with a whole person. And ultimately realizing that everybody, as Bob Dylan said, he's a great theologian. It may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. Everyone's in that place. Everybody has to choose God, that which we believe is unconditionally reliable, and that choice is made from the heart. So the last two models I present, both are essential to understanding a right relationship. Reason leads to faith, but faith shapes understanding. And I think if we get those two right, and in their proper place, we can be really, really good apologists. What is the heart? And
the relationship, between heart, mind, spirit, soul.
Yeah.
All those others.
Yep. We're talking about anthropology here, and there's lots of different anthropologies. The ones that aren't biblical all reduce the heart to one of these. So the Greeks reduce the core, the person, ultimately to mind. We had bodies and we had minds, and it was the mind, the unseen part of us, which really was our core, our center. When we talk about heart, we're just talking about our core. So this, for me, is the concentration point that holds all of our capacities together. They're all integrated, concentrated in the heart. And that is our center. And actually, for me, heart is synonymous with I. The I, call it person. You can call it soul. Identity. It certainly involves that, absolutely. Self. We've just used different words for this. It's such a mystery that we need a different kind of language to describe it. But when this is reduced to any one of this, we've violated ourselves. So many today talk about love God with your head and your heart. What do they mean? That with your head and your feelings. Well, that's to reduce the heart to our feelings. It's a reduction. That's a huge question that you've asked. But does that give you a little way forward? Don't reduce the heart, our core, to any of our capacities. Yeah, it's more than that too, I said yesterday. It's not add up the sum of us, and that's our heart. This here integrates, and it's the concentration point, the reference point for everything that we can do, all of our capacities. But the heart is not signified in any of these. The heart, the eye, the center of us, can only be signified in God. That's what it means to be the image of God. This has to be fixed. That's Augustine. Our hearts are restless till they find their rest in you, because that's what we're made for, relationship with Him. It's Ellis's point this morning that the person doesn't exist as a unit to himself. We exist in relationship, and we were made for relationship with God. He qualifies us. The quality of the human self is in God. We are His image. We are representation. A representation needs the signified. We are signifiers. Who's the signified? It's God. When we're in relationship, we become ourselves in the fullest way. Yeah.
I have a question regarding still reason and experience.
Yep.
That I believe, I think I understand people who tend to go go towards this kind of ideal, because I think we can see people who reason themselves out from experiences with God. So would you say that, how can I define the dangerous part of reasoning? Because as what you say, if a person has faith, he cannot reason out himself further from God.
Yeah.
If he has proper faith and bow down before God. But still maybe there are people who does that. For example, if there is a religious, a faith experience, God is doing something, and there is a person who is rather examining it than participating.
Yep.
And there are those people whose life is many examination and testing and watching rather than participating.
Yep.
So if you want to say in a simple way, how could be dangerous for Christians, or there is no danger at all, and we should forget about thinking reason as a danger.
There's dangers everywhere. If Christianity is reduced to an abstraction, rationality takes different forms. One is that we can abstract, we can theorize about something, we can create a model, but the model is not the reality. So if Christianity just becomes a model, God becomes an idea and nothing more, we've got a problem. But we also have a problem if we reduce God to a feeling. Experience touches all of these things, but we moderns have made experience what I call first order experience, which is feeling. The first order of any experience is through our feelings. If we reduce experience to that, we have a problem. But I'd say, as I'm thinking, I'm having an experience. So I think there's loads of dangers, and they're all reductions. The problem with moderns is we love to reduce. It's a way of gaining control, and we're not opened to the expansiveness of reality, how one thing leads to another, and everything has its place in its integrity. We love to reduce. So if we reduce God to an idea, wrong. If we reduce him to an experience, wrong. So it goes both ways. And the danger today is many people reduce God to an experience. Yeah, thank you. Good, Marcia.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.